about 7 months ago, I still believed that it was all legit and that God was real. I used to be a Mormon and a Mormon missionary, and now I am not a Mormon. Mormonism turned me into an atheist.
This is Arrivals, stories of migration, transformation, and change. The program that explores what we do when what we've done is a thing of the past. And today we bring you a special collaboration with the Borders Radio podcast. We're calling it Conversion.
My name is Nicholas Lloyd Perrett. I'm 22 years old, and I'm from Australia, a little town called Gerringong, 2 hours south of Sydney. Growing up, I was kind of indoctrinated or taught that when you're 19, you go on a mission, but you have to be super spiritual and really righteous and kind of follow everything. But I never followed any of the rules when I was younger. So I never thought that I'd be allowed on a mission. And then I had felt really, really guilty about not following the rules, and got to a point where I felt like I had to, change my life around, which meant I had to kind of cut myself off from a lot of my friends that I was hanging out with. And then all my friends became Mormons. So I felt like because I wasn't allowed to drink, or I wasn't allowed to sleep with girls or anything like that, or do anything like a normal teenager would, I became really, really obsessed with those things and got into them way too much. I had an addiction to some drugs and some alcohol. The church had an addiction recovery program that I went through probably 3 times, which didn't help. But I kept failing all the time. And that meant that, like in my head, that meant that I couldn't go on a mission, or I couldn't get into heaven. I remember standing in front of the mirror, looking at myself and just hating myself. And I remember banging my head on the ground, punching myself in the face. And one time, going up to a little spot, it was like a lookout over a surf break that I'd go to a lot when I was young, and it was pretty high up. And I remember just standing at the edge of it, just thinking that that would be an easier way out than measuring up to the kind of impossible expectations that were put on me from such a young age, that I thought, yeah, I could just stop it now rather than dig myself deeper into a hole that I wouldn't be forgiven for. Thinking if I keep going like this, then I'm fucked. But if I jump, then I'm more fucked. So I just kind of sat down and just cried. It was both pushing me to the edge of the cliff and then pulling me away from the cliff. But I didn't realize at the time that that was the problem. Wasn't me, but it was, the church. The church is kind of like a drug cartel where it creates the demand for, creates the sin by giving impossible expectations for people to reach, which they can't, so they fall, they sin, then they feel guilty. So then they have to go to church to get absolution from that guilt. But then they'll always fail. So they're always going back and they're always feeling guilty. So it's just like this never ending cycle of failing, guilt, and depression. So I kind of moved mountains in my life to be able to go on a mission. I remember getting off the plane and I was wearing a three-piece suit, which we had to wear, and I get off the plane and it's like I just had like a really warm shower. It was so humid and I just got off and was like sweating everywhere instantly. Walking through the airport, there was like a group of guys playing guitar and ukulele and singing, and they're all guys, but they were singing like ridiculously high. They're like really loud and really high, and I loved it. I felt like I was gonna baptize everybody, and I just needed to get good at Fijian. Then I'd have everybody in the water baptizing them. I felt like I was gonna be really, I guess, successful. Baptism as a Mormon missionary is like the main goal. It's like what everybody's after is like more baptisms, and every meeting that we have is about baptizing people and like how to get them ready for baptism. And people just want to run around just dunking people pretty much, like, because you get it, you can say like, I baptized this many people on my mission. It's really weird. It's mostly about the numbers of baptisms and like not really what it's about, but just like, I guess, bragging rights. The first ones I did were in the ocean, which were pretty cool. We had to walk out really far because it was low tide and we were trying to find like a dip in the sand so they could actually go all the way under. And then like you stand with them, put your arm up in the air and say their name and say, wait, this is weird remembering this, but you say,
having been commissioned of Jesus Christ, I baptize you in the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Amen.
And then you'd like dunk them under. And bring them up. And then like you're waiting for something like crazy to happen, like heavens open and a dove descend or something, and it's just like nothing. You're like, boom, okay, yeah, you can get dressed now. And then like they're just like soaked and you're standing there like, is there anything else that happens in this? I think I physically baptized, I think, 12 people, but a lot of people that I taught ended up getting baptized, maybe around 20 or more. We were teaching his family, and the dad or the husband was always away. And then he came, and he was kind of like, he showed up one time and he wasn't really impressed with us teaching his family. But then we sat down with him and I started kind of talking to him and got him really interested. And then he became like the most interested out of all of them. And we sat with him all the time and went through all the lessons with him. And he'd had a book, he'd have like a notebook with him, and he'd be writing everything down that we said. And really excited to get baptized. And then I remember like I think like 4 or 5 months later, coming back to that area randomly, like I got to go see them, which I didn't think I'd ever see them again. And he was just, he like started crying when he saw me, and they were all like so happy to see me, and they felt like I had helped them out a lot. And yeah, they still talk to me now, but I haven't really explained things yet to them of what's happened since. They were the best, and I think I ruined their life. Thank you. my dad sent me a link to some essays that the church had released while I was on my mission. And he just said, hey, these are some things that the church has put out about some difficult questions that people get asked a lot about church history, and you should have a read of it so you can help people if they have these questions. I was like, oh, cool. Yeah, I'll read into it. So I printed off these essays and took them back to the flat that we had. And each night after the day was over, like, come home and I'd sit down and read one of these essays. And I guess that was the beginning of the end. So since the beginning of the church has had all its records of historical events that happen in the church. They'd had it, like, locked up in the archives, and they wouldn't let anybody read it. And then in the, I think it was the 80s, they let a few church historians look at what was in the archives and write some books about it. And but these guys, these historians, got I guess locked down. I don't know if they got excommunicated, but they got, like, frozen out, because when they started publishing the things that they found, the leaders of the church kind of freaked out and locked up the archives again and wouldn't let anybody read them because it was completely different to what they had said this whole time about who Joseph Smith was, or how the Book of Mormon was translated and all these things. And then when the internet was invented, everybody could read this stuff. So people were reading it and then asking questions and then getting excommunicated because the stuff that they were reading was supposedly anti-Mormon literature. But then it turns out that it's actually Mormon literature. So when I was reading, my dad was constantly giving me a way out. He said, you don't have to keep reading if you don't want to. And I just had this image in my head come up of Morpheus from The Matrix. He's just holding, like, two pills. It's like, you either go down the rabbit hole or you, like, forget about it all, wake up in The Matrix and just go about your life. Like, nothing's changed. And that was, like, the turning point, I guess, in my whole life, was not wanting to be stuck in a fraud, not to be stuck in The Matrix. So I was like, yeah, fuck that. I want it all. Like, send me everything that you have. So I read these essays. Some really important issues that came up in these essays were Joseph Smith was, he had about 40 wives before he died, and 10 of them, or 11 of them, were already married to other people. And he was found sleeping with a 14-year-old girl when he was already married. And then after that, he came up with this revelation of polygamy, where God wants wanted him to take on other wives, and his wife didn't agree with it, but he did it all in secret and married all these really young girls. And then another thing was the translation of the Book of Mormon, which I had been teaching about for 2 years. So I had been teaching that Joseph Smith had these gold plates that he found, and he would read what was on the plates, but it was in a different language, and it'd be translated into English by the power of God. But really, he had this seer stone that, as a kid, he'd used to find buried treasure, and he put it in a hat and put his head in a hat, and then he'd just apparently read out what was or the translation of it. So that's the real version, and the church has admitted that, oh yeah, that's the actual version, but they'd been teaching a different version for 100 years. So it was a Monday, I got the last bit of information from my dad, and then I looked at my companion, Elder Farmway, just went, I gotta go, gotta get out of here. I'm not doing this because it's good for me. I felt like this was something real, but it's not. So I was out. You have to wear garments, like the magic underwear, magic woman underwear. And I just had this moment, it was so funny, where I was like, I don't have to wear these anymore. Yes! And like, I took them off and I was running around my flat just in like underwear, just like dancing. And I started giving away all my stuff, like my scriptures, like my Book of Mormon. Like, I was like, here you go, you can have this. And he's like, you don't want it? I'm like, I don't fucking need that thing anymore. So it was a Tuesday. So the mission president keeps everybody's passport so they can't just bounce, which now I realize is really fucked up. So we went to the office where the mission president and his wife live, and the mission president came up. President Layton from Salt Lake City, Utah. Okay, if you picture, I can't remember his name, but the main guy from Despicable Me. It's like really tall, like... He used to be skinny, but now he's got like really fat belly, big pointy nose, and like bald, and like has his hands together like Mr. Burns. That's President Layton, but with white hair. So I go into his office and he asked me what he can help me with. I said, I know that the church is a fraud. I want to go home. I don't want to talk about it now. Just give me my passport and I'm going. My parents know about this. I've got a plane ticket already. And he was like blown away and didn't really know what to do. I don't think he expected that. He said, well, let's just start in a prayer. Like, and then he's like, I'll say the prayer. I'm like, yeah, you'll say the prayer. And he wouldn't budge. He wouldn't give me my passport for over 2 hours. And then I just said, look, guy, I've been on the phone already with the Australian High Commission or the Australian Embassy, and they know that there is an organization in Fiji withholding my passport from me. So I can call them. You can tell them why you're not giving me my passport. So his face kind of went like all gray and realized that he could be in a lot of trouble. And then he made a prediction about my life after my mission. He said he's met a lot of people that have been excommunicated or left the church. And he said, the only way to have true happiness that I've seen is within the gospel. The only way to have happiness is in the gospel. And he said, without it, you will have divorce. You will have alcoholism. You will have addiction. Your family will fall apart. You'll have depression. You'll have all these things. I thought like I was going to go to hell or something, but I felt so good. I think I described it as taking off a hot woolen jumper in the middle of summer, just like feeling this lightness, this freedom. So I got off the plane, got to the airport, and I saw my mom, and she was so happy to see me. She looked really different to when I left. And I just kind of walked up and hugged her for a long time. And so my parents had been researching the church for, I guess, 2 years, the time that I'd been on my mission, and they had left the church 6 weeks before I came home, and I didn't know that. So I guess we all felt like refugees. The feeling like we've found this out, we've discovered the truth, and like we need to tell other people about what we found. And when we tell them, then they'll realize that it's all wrong as well, and they'll come out and they'll see how good life is. But in reality, it's much different. It's more like, whoa, you're the devil. Stay away from me. Yeah, I had much more success converting people to Mormonism than getting them out of Mormonism. As soon as I got home, the mission president went about trying to fulfill that prophecy about tearing up my family. He called my brother's mission presidents, because I have two brothers that are also on missions, one in Auckland and one in Singapore. And he told their mission presidents this messed up story, this warped story of why I left and what I was doing. And then After that, they didn't want to talk to me, and I only just got to talk to them at Christmas. And then he spread word to people back at home, and it got to my cousins, and they don't talk to me anymore. So he tried to, yeah, mess up my family just so his prophecy would come true. He did a little bit of a good job, so I'm trying to reverse that at the moment. I was completely lost. I didn't know how to function. For a few months, I lost my voice. Like, I couldn't talk anymore. I guess it was a combination of coming from Fiji and back to English, and having lied for 2 years, told people so many lies, I just couldn't trust my voice anymore. And then I couldn't really talk, couldn't form sentences properly. I didn't feel like everybody was dumb or needed my help, but I felt like I was dumb and I needed to learn from everybody else how they live their life. So I realized that I haven't been living life for my whole life. I would say to the people that I helped get baptized, or the people that I converted or baptized, that I am very sorry. I didn't know what I was getting them into. I didn't realize that what I was teaching was not true. I really thought that I was doing something good. I really thought that I would help them. And now I realize that I didn't help them. That I might have made their life a little worse off. And I'm really sorry. And yeah, they try and talk to me a lot and I don't know what to say. I love them a lot. It's really hard to talk to them, knowing what I did. I'm very sorry. I ask forgiveness.
Special thanks to Caitlin Pierce and Borders Radio for co-producing this story with us, and to Steph Tan for episode art. Check out more stories from Borders Radio at bordersradio.org. Arrivals is a proud and founding member of The Herd, a storytelling collective featuring independent producers from across North America. Listen in at theherdradio.com. That's the H-E-A-R-D radio.com. And help support this show by leaving us a review on iTunes and signing up for our special subscription service through the Acast app. Details can be found at our website, arrvls.com. I'm Jonathan Hirsch. Thank you for listening. And until we meet again, may you wind up where you need to be.